Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. An excessive heat warning remains with us through Wednesday around the valley. We're expecting to potentially reach a high of 117 degrees today. That would break the record of 115 set in 1968. Then look for clear skies tonight, low temperatures around 90. And then for tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high of 113. Currently with relative humidity at 9%, it's mostly clear and 110 degrees at KJZZ. Officials with Sky Harbor Airport say they're not expecting any significant delays because of excessive heat this week. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, most major airlines can operate in conditions as hot as 150 degrees.
Can hot temperatures really keep an airplane from flying? In the U.S., yes. That happened in Phoenix in June of 1990 because most major U.S. airliners didn't have takeoff and landing calculations extrapolated past 120 degrees. Things have changed since then. Ronald Carr is a professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott. He says for the most part, airplane manufacturers have tested their products in conditions up to 150 degrees.
When you're selling an airplane around the world, you've got to cover the Northwest Territories in Canada in the middle of winter when the temperature is really cold, all the way to Dubai when the temperature's can get to 125, 130.
Carr adds the data is out there and most airlines have updated their calculations. It's just a matter of whether or not they want to pay for additional charts. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
While one plane was turned away, it was still business as usual for most airlines, and as travelers touched down, they had a new option to get home. This weekend was the first time UberX was allowed to officially pick up riders at Sky Harbor Airport. Deputy Aviation Director at the airport, Julie Rodriguez, joins us with an update. Julie, good afternoon. And were there a lot of people using their phones instead of hailing cabs this weekend?
Well, we had many people using their phones to call transportation network companies or TNCs, and we had just as many people, or actually more, hailing cabs over the weekend. It was busy at Sky Harbor.
Well, so how is the airport monitoring the service to see how it's working, how many people are using it?
Over the weekend, more than 2,000 people called Uber or Lyft to pick them up at the airport. And then we had nearly 3,000 taxi trips. We have ground transportation staff working the curbs and making sure everything is orderly. Uber and Lyft have a separate area where they pick up on the curb, and our staff monitors to make sure that the drivers have proper permits and that they have actually been called by a customer they've been dispatched to pick up a customer.
So with the new service coming into place, did it cause any safety problems over the weekend? Could there be an increase in traffic or problems now that you have the new fleet of drivers showing up at Sky Harbor?
We have not seen any safety issues. It is very orderly. In order for an Uber or a Lyft to come on the property and pick up a customer, they have to be called through the app. And so that it is regulated in that way. The only ground transportation service that is available for walk-up is cab service or super shuttle at the airport. And we have additional staff out on the curb monitoring and making sure that everything goes smoothly.
And Julie, finally, is there a system in place to, let's say, review things on a weekly, monthly, quarterly basis?
We are tracking every trip. We have technology that tracks every pickup, whether it's a cab pickup or a transportation network company pickup at the curb. And we also have staff out monitoring 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to make sure that everything runs smoothly.
Julie Rodriguez is Deputy Aviation Director at Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. Julie, thank you.
Thank you.
Republicans are getting ready for next month's national convention in Cleveland, typically a time of celebration. But the intra-party conflict over expected nominee Donald Trump has put up some obstacles and caused some delegates to resign and not even attend the convention. Among others, Attorney General Mark Brnovich and Secretary of State Michelle Reagan have decided not to be delegates. To learn more about what's going on, I'm joined by Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, even huge Trump supporter State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt has resigned as a delegate. Why is this happening?
Why it's happening depends on which delegate you talk to. I mean, Jeff DeWitt, of course, not doing this out of any opposition to Trump. He's, you know, Trump's Arizona State Chairman. He's on cable news all the time as a Trump surrogate. He's resigning. He said he resigned as a delegate because he wanted to open up a spot for the next alternate in his congressional district, in the 8th Congressional District, which is State Representative Phil Lovas, another big Trump supporter. And then that opened up another alternate spot for another Trump supporter. DeWitt said, you know, he's going to have a role at the convention with the Trump folks either way. So we figured he'd open that up for some good Trump supporters. The other folks... Other folks have different reasoning. Obviously, we had two who said very explicitly that they could not in good conscience go to Cleveland and vote for Donald Trump, and that is Zudi Jasser, who's a doctor and a Muslim reform advocate here in the Valley, and Frank Riggs, a former California congressman who was a Republican gubernatorial candidate out here in Arizona in 2014. Both said they won't go for Trump. And then there are several others who did not say that they were doing it in opposition to Trump, but suddenly realized they had other things, better things they had to do that week.
Well, it does sound odd, even with when we heard about Senators McCain and Flake, a lot of people seem to be a little bit tentative about that. People like Mark Brnovich, Michelle Reagan, Attorney General and Secretary of State, wouldn't these typically be people who would attend and would be happy to attend?
And normally you would think so, and those were the two top vote-getters in the delegate voting at the Arizona Republican Party State Convention in Mesa at the end of April. And, Secretary Reagan, her office said, well, she wants to stay in Arizona and focus on, preparing for the August 30th primary out here. Obviously, there have been a number of issues with the elections out here this year, so that seems... seems like a decent reason to avoid the convention. Brnovich, his office said, well, he's got a lot going on this weekend, so he'll just open it up for, an alternate and let, he'll stay here and take care of his duties as AG and spend time with his family, I believe was how they put it.
Zudi Jasser is very outspoken about Islam and Syria and that sort of thing. What did he say to you specifically about why he is opposing Trump?
Well, Zudi Jasser, he kind of comes at this from a unique perspective. I mean, many of his gripes about Donald Trump are the same as any other conservative Republican you hear. But he also comes at this from the perspective of an American Muslim, someone who is very outspoken about what he feels is the need to reform it and modernize it in ways that are consistent with American values. And he's very hawkish on going after folks like ISIS, like the Assad regime in Syria. But still, as a Muslim, obviously, that is not a demographic that Donald Trump has endeared himself to. And Dr. Jasser does have a lot of concerns about kind of what views as, the demonization of Muslims, of, wanting to, at least temporarily ban Muslim immigration, a lot of these things.
And final question for you, does this indicate anything about Arizona's delegation that we should be thinking more deeply about? I mean, are there certain people in the Arizona delegation who are going to try to maybe deny Donald Trump the nomination?
There may be. I mean, just in the past few days, we've been seeing a lot of national reporting on this kind of movement among some of the delegates and other Republicans. I believe they're calling it now Free the Delegates. They want at the convention, they want the convention to adopt what they're calling a conscience clause that will allow delegates to vote against Trump on the first ballot. Calling around with delegates now, trying to find out kind of who from Arizona is involved. I know word has been kind of spreading among some of them. Perhaps they resigned a bit hastily. There might still be, the anti-Trump forces might still try to make a play in Cleveland next month.
Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, we always appreciate your insights. Thanks, man.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks a lot.
Arizona isn't the only Republican-leaning state with concerns about expected presidential nominee Donald Trump. Many Utah voters are also hesitant to get behind Trump. Some of that has to do with his style, while others are offended by his comments about Muslims. Mormons in particular are unhappy about how that could reflect his general feelings about religious freedom. To learn more, I'm joined by BYU Associate Professor of Political Science Quinn Monson. Quinn, for those people who are not based in Utah, and they've heard former presidential nominee Mitt Romney be very openly critical of Trump, without painting with too broad a brush, how much of the opposition to Trump does have to do with religious freedom?
You know, I think it goes deeper than that, and I think you can combine a whole bunch of different factors, but one of the biggest ones is the history of Mormonism in the United States and the history of persecution suffered by Mormons back in the 19th century in places like Missouri and Illinois. And so it wasn't that long ago, especially for Mormons that go back a few generations in the church, that ancestors were driven out because of their religion from Illinois and from Missouri. And so that's something that I think that many Mormons are acutely aware of, and that makes them especially receptive to to a message from Romney that helps activate that objection to Donald Trump's rhetoric about Hispanics, about Muslims, and just his overall brashness and language is a problem for many Mormons, I think.
Now, Utah, like Arizona, tends to certainly lean Republican, especially when it comes to presidential votes. What does this say about the direction of Republican leadership at the highest federal level when it comes to this getting ready for the convention, especially in places with large LDS populations? Does this indicate potentially more trouble, at least at the presidential level, for Republicans because you have this hesitation in a state or even more than one state that tends to very consistently go Republican?
Well, yeah, there's polling in Utah from multiple sources now that suggests that Donald Trump is in trouble. It doesn't mean Hillary Clinton's going to walk away with 50% of the vote but with the presence of a third-party candidate, there is a place for voters who are unhappy with their choices to go and vote. And so you could see, I think, potentially somebody like Hillary Clinton, who is also deeply unpopular with Utahns and with Mormon Republicans, end up winning the state with a vote in the high 30%. And I think there's large enough Mormon populations in places like Arizona, Nevada, and maybe even Colorado that have had competitive statewide races in the last few years that could spell trouble for Donald Trump.
One thing related to what you mentioned about the third party candidates, Gary Johnson, a former governor, he's running with William Weld, also a former governor. And both of them have been, certainly when it comes to economics, are very much on the conservative side of things. What would you think would appeal to Utah voters in general, maybe LDS voters more specifically, that might help them garner 10 to 15% of the vote?
Well, it is that economic conservatism, because the social liberalism, the libertarian ticket, is not appealing to Mormon voters. So if that's the main thrust of the Johnson ticket, then that might spell trouble. But I think there may be a turnout problem or whatever the opposite of drop-off on the ballot is, right? I mean, what we usually think of is people voting for president and then skipping races down ballot. What you may see some Mormons do is vote for Senate or governor or House and skip the presidential race because they don't have an option that they feel like they want to vote for.
And Quinn, final question for you. This sort of harkens back a number of years, so I'm not sure if it is still valid or not, but when Arizona approved SB 1070 and there was a clear delineation, it seemed, between a number of LDS residents in Arizona, certainly not everyone, and a number of LDS residents in Utah, where the feeling was that some in the Arizona camp were being a little bit too harsh when it came to even separating families, when it came to undocumented immigrants and that sort of thing. Do you see broader differences between how Utah LDS Republicans might view these issues as opposed to Arizona LDS Republicans? Do Utah LDS Republicans really stand out on their own in many ways?
No, I actually think they're quite similar. I think the majority of Mormons are in a position on that kind of issue that is consistent with the church's own statements, which are very moderate and would speak toward these ideas of keeping families intact together and finding a way to help people come out of the shadows and become square with the law while not encouraging a total amnesty. The church has taken this position that doesn't quite get too definitive, but very carefully tries to encourage families to stay together. That's very different from the rhetoric we hear from Donald Trump.
Quinn Monson is a professor of political science at Brigham Young University. Quinn, thanks very much for the time.
No problem. Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5 for Monday, June 20th. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. The U.S. Supreme Court resisted taking up the gun control issue today. It decided not to rule in a case out of Connecticut. Meanwhile, the Senate is going to vote on four gun bills today, 1 week after the mass shooting in Orlando. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced the votes as a condition to end Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy's filibuster last week. And debates on the issue will apparently be heard in both the Senate and at least the corridors of the House. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us now.
So the debate in the Senate, this will be a precursor to passage or to failure?
Well, the four bills that are going to be debated today and voted on this evening, John, precursor to failure, at least on policy grounds. There's no doubt about that. I'm comfortable telling you that these four different gun bills in the aftermath of the Orlando shooting are going to fail. That doesn't make the debate useless. And I'm also going to tell you about a legitimate potential compromise between Republicans and Democrats that is brewing behind the scenes that could see the light of day within a day or two. So we'll get to that. Today, John, four bills, as you said, up for the vote in the Senate, keeping people on the FBI terror watch list from buying guns. This is a Dianne Feinstein proposal. It would keep people who have been on that list from buying weapons because the system would ping the background check system. They would be denied sales of guns under that new law. There's also going to be a vote to expand universal background checks, that old bill, you're familiar with it, to make the background check law apply to gun shows, close that so-called gun show loophole. There's a couple of Republican amendments as well. John Cornyn, the Republican whip, has a bill that would bar people on the FBI watch list from purchasing guns if law enforcement can convince a judge within 3 days that there's probable cause to keep that person from buying a gun. One of the controversies here is that it's really easy to get on an FBI watch list, and that the legal standard is a lot lower than the one that you would need to deny someone their constitutional right under the Second Amendment to buy a gun. So law enforcement under the Cornyn proposal would have to show probable cause. The NRA backs that proposal, by the way, so Cornyn is sitting well with Republicans on that one. Not a lot of Democrats support it. And then a fourth bill from Chuck Grassley that would improve the notification of the FBI if someone does try to buy a gun so that they can step up their law enforcement efforts. Now, I did say that all four of these are likely to fail, but I talked to Chris Murphy, who staged that filibuster that you mentioned, John, and he says, no, it's all been worth it.
If we didn't have a vote scheduled on the Feinstein proposal, I don't think that we would have people scurrying around trying to find potential compromises. So I see this all as positive.
Is Murphy saying that people on the House side are scurrying around trying to find potential compromises?
No, he's saying that people in the Senate side are trying to do that. Murphy is also saying that, look, these changes don't happen overnight. There's a tradition in this country, John, after every mass shooting we've seen over the last couple of years. The Senate debates, the Senate holds a vote, that vote fails. You are right back where you started. Murphy's point here is that if you peel a couple of Republicans over to his side, if you move people off of their positions, especially in votes that are near elections, that that's how policy eventually gets changed, especially on a divisive, polarizing issue like guns. But you did ask about the people scurrying around to make the compromises, and there is one that's being cobbled together behind the scenes that's also going to be introduced later on today. Republican moderate senator from Maine, Susan Collins, has been talking to a list of Republicans and Democrats, and she has a compromise position here. She says, don't use the FBI watch list, which is really easy to get on without probable cause. Let's use a narrower list, the no-fly list, the ones where you actually have to probably be, in most cases, under suspicion to be on there. You can use that list to deny people the right to buy a gun under the Collins bill. Not only that, if you're denied a right to buy a gun, you can go to a judge and appeal it in court. If you win that appeal, you get your legal fees refunded by the government. It also has what's called a look-back provision. It lets the FBI look back 5 years to anyone who was on the list, even if they're not anymore, and potentially deny them the sale of a gun under certain circumstances. Now, that would have applied in this case to Omar Mateen, who was under FBI scrutiny, of course, but wasn't at the time when he tried to buy his gun, and that is controversial. Now, I talked to Susan Collins about what she's trying to do here, given the fact that those other four votes that we talked about, John, are probably going to fail tonight.
Rather than doing Groundhog Day, I think it's time for a new approach and a more targeted one. And that's what we've been working hard all week to try to put together.
So is she anticipating a positive vote on that compromise?
Unclear, except that it's likely to be taken more seriously than the other four votes that we've talked about because of Groundhog Day. They've been voted on before and they've been voted down, which is why I'm so comfortable telling you that they're going to fail tonight. Collins is saying, look, we can actually adjust some of the details here. We can give maybe political cover to people who are nervous about voting against their party orthodoxy so close to an election. And maybe let's give it a shot, people, and show people that we might be able to legislate here. That's her hope.
That's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick and John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Phoenix is the third largest city in the country when it comes to the number of indigenous people who live here. That has led to a strong push for the city to actually mark that significance with an Indigenous Peoples Day. The effort's being led by Jeff Malcuna, Carlos Brava. And a hearing of the city's Heritage Commission will consider the proposal this afternoon at 4:30. And Jeff and Carlos join me now. Jeff, why do you think this is an important concept, and why should Phoenix adopt it?
You know, I got the idea to do this about 2 years ago, Steve, when I began researching the idea behind Indigenous Peoples Day and other cities that had recognized it. And actually, Carlos and I have worked on that research since then. And Carlos actually composed a list of 33 municipalities across the country that have actually adopted Indigenous Peoples Day resolutions or something comparable. Phoenix would be the largest city to do it. But it makes sense because in our research, we actually learned that Phoenix has the third largest Indigenous population in the country. So it was one of those things where the further we went with it, the more we realized, you know, how much sense it really made for Phoenix to do this and not to be the last one to do it.
How important is this as it relates to respect? How much of it is acknowledging this important part of history, or is there something deeper there?
I want to say that it's more of an acknowledgement and just realizing the history of the city and how it was founded on an ancient civilization, the Hohokam, and they've been, you know, it's the markers are around and it's visible. And so I think the primary goal is acknowledgement. But I think also an education piece as well, and realizing, you know, we're native. Those of us that are natives here, it makes sense to have that piece of history as you're growing up and learning about it.
Jeff, to what extent does a holiday sort of cement that?
One of my favorite lines in the resolution, that the draft resolution we've composed, is the city of Phoenix recognizes the fact that Phoenix is built upon the homelands and villages of the indigenous peoples of this region, without whom the building of the city would not have been made possible. And we have to remember, you know, Phoenix is literally built on the ruins of ancient civilizations, and we wouldn't be in this location. We wouldn't be here without these civilizations and the infrastructure that they left to us. So it absolutely makes sense that we have at least one day on the calendar in the city of Phoenix to commemorate this.
Did you guys get a chance to look at resolutions in other communities, and how is yours perhaps different because Phoenix having such a large indigenous population and also being such a big city?
Yeah, we looked into it pretty extensively and found many cities, especially recently, have a city resolution. So we looked at cities like San Antonio, Seattle, Minneapolis, large cities in the nation, and we adopted some of the meaning or some of the pieces that they had as far as meeting our goal of what we wanted to do with it here in Phoenix. So some of the language is it's similar, but we also added elements that are unique to Phoenix, and that would make sense.
Have you gotten a vibe as to how people feel about it? Have they given you an honest assessment of your chances or what they think of the idea?
Enthusiastically positive responses from all city officials that we've spoken to up to this point. And the Historic Preservation Commission really thinks we've got a great shot at making this happen this year. So we're excited about that, Steve.
The fact that Phoenix has such a huge indigenous population, does this make Phoenix look pretty bad that we haven't already had this to some extent?
That's a great question, Steve. I don't think it does. I think that being the 34th municipality in the country to do this actually puts us really at the forefront of cities to do this. We would be the largest city to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day and the first in Arizona. So there's a lot of firsts here, and I don't think it would make us look bad in any way.
Jeff Malcuna and Carlos Brava, they're leading the effort to create an Indigenous Peoples Day in Phoenix. If approved by the city, it would be marked on the second Monday of October, coinciding with the federal observance of Columbus Day. In the Greek capital, Athens, a huge registration exercise is going on to clear the backlog of migrants who may want to apply for asylum in the European Union. More than 50,000 migrants are stuck in Greece after neighboring countries closed their borders. The BBC's Andrew Bomford reports as the processing began.
On the site of the old, long disused airport in Athens, it's a bizarre scene. Next to the derelict departures gate, but going nowhere, are hundreds of migrants who've been camped here for months. Across this whole sprawling site, about 3,600 migrants are waiting. They're given meals and basic toilet facilities, but it's only now that their asylum claims are starting to be heard.
I am from Afghanistan.
And when did you get to Greece?
3 months.
3 months. And today you're waiting to register for the first time?
Yeah. today we are waiting for register here.
Did you think it would take so long?
Yeah, 3 months is a very long time.
How long have you been in Greece for?
In Greece?
Yes.
4 months.
And have you been here at the airport all that time or somewhere else?
No, here.
Here?
Yeah. We live in a tent.
In a tent?
Yeah.
Which country do you want to go to?
I want to go to Germany.
To Germany?
Or Sweden or Austria.
Most of the migrants here at the old airport are from Afghanistan, but Alexandra Krauss from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees Office says Afghans will not be eligible for relocation in other European countries.
The main nationalities, the Syrian and Iraqis, they fall under the relocation scheme. The Afghan nationals, unfortunately, do not qualify for relocation.
I come to Germany or Holland or every country.
Any country?
Just not Greece.
Not Greece?
Yeah.
It means dreams of living in Germany or Scandinavia are likely to be dashed. The only option for people here is to apply for asylum in Greece, as it's the first European country they're registering in. Official stamps are put on new identity documents. It's the start of a brand new process to clear the backlog of 57,000 migrants across Greece since the borders closed in February.
This is an emergency measure, if you like, to address an extraordinary situation. The problem is much, much bigger than we and other member states could collectively address in such a short time frame.
Today, the head of the Greek Asylum Service, Maria Stavropoulou, came to the processing centre, set up in UN tents on the old airport taxiway, to see the pre-registration exercise get underway. EU countries have sent experts to help, but she says there's still a huge mountain to climb.
This is a very, very big problem, and of course it's not just a question of other member states sending experts. We need to be able to support those experts as well. So it's a complicated process, and that's why it's going a little bit slower than everybody, including ourselves, would hope.
So far, 87 experts, as they're described, have arrived in Greece to carry out interviews for Syrians and Iraqis who qualify for relocation elsewhere in Europe. 11 experts are here from the UK. It's being handled by the European Asylum Support Office. And Patricia van der Peer from EASO says the numbers could be increased.
Our member states are willing, and they also is willing to coordinate more experts. Of course, we will increase our numbers once the moment is there and once we have enough counterparts at the Greek side.
It could be a very long process. Here in Athens, only 10 experts are available to carry out asylum interviews for Syrians and Iraqis.
You need to have a little bit of patience. Not everybody can come today. Later, you will get registered. Okay? Not today.
5 months, 6 months sleep.
Yes, out in the street.
Yes.
So for migrants like this man who was standing there in tears, it means many more months sleeping rough on the streets of Athens. This place might have been an airport, but few are getting out of here soon.
That's the BBC's Andrew Bomford. The United Nations Refugee Agency says the number of people displaced by conflict has reached the highest level ever recorded. Releasing its annual report on forced displacement, the UN says that at the end of 2015, more than 65 million people worldwide were refugees, asylum seekers, or internally displaced. But there is recognition of the culture and experience those that have been forcibly displaced bring with them. To honor these differences, the United Nations has declared today World Refugee Day. It's celebrated around the globe and here in Arizona. KJZZ's Regina Revazova reports.
I love all my kids, but you've stuck out quite a bit to me. So I want to introduce Diakre Chris by his friends, Chris Segarra.
They're fleeing their country because of war, violence, or persecution.
I had never heard about this event before, so I didn't plan a speech.
And most likely they'll never go back home. I'm at the Refugee Focus, which resettles and assists the newcomers. It joins many civic and faith-based groups around the world to host the World Refugee Day. And the goal is
to bring attention and awareness to
the refugee plight across the world.
That's the director of Refugee Focus, Craig Thorson. He has been working with refugees off and on for more than 40 years. And back then, he says, things were different.
There weren't developed networks. They were very informal. Those refugees came to camps, military camps in the United States, and then were dispersed across the country through organizations like mine.
Today, the resettlement has become more structured, while the number of asylum seekers is climbing through the roof.
In Arizona, we will see this coming year 5,000 refugees. About 75% will come to Phoenix from Iraq, the Congo, Syria, Somalia, Iran, Afghanistan.
But there are others, like Omari Habanimana from Burundi, working 7 days a week, oftentimes two shifts in a row. He says America is the best thing that could have happened to him and his seven kids.
No, I said that is a gift from God, because many, many people in Africa, they are looking a chance to come in America, but the chance they can't get.
The World Refugee Day isn't only about the awareness. There is at least one more reason behind it, which is to celebrate, with ethnic dishes and music, the resilience and the spirit of refugees. For KJZZ News, I'm Regina Revazova.
And in news from KJZZ, in the state of Oaxaca, southern Mexico, six people are reported dead and 53 injured after the local police clashed yesterday with protesters from a teachers' union. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes joins me to talk about this. It's another chapter of a three-year story of confrontations between teacher organizations and the Mexican government. So, Rodrigo, what happened in Oaxaca?
Yesterday, police tried to dislodge protesters blocking a highway in Nochitlan. This is at the southern state of Oaxaca. The blockade, as others in the past, attempted to affect the traffic and also the transportation of fuel from refineries operated by Pemex, as well as gas stations. Violence erupted in the middle of the confusion. Gunshots, explosions, probably from Molotov cocktails, were heard, according to witnesses. And according to the government of Oaxaca, none of the six deceased are members of the teachers' union, and the government also attributes the violence to infiltrated masked gunmen.
Well, let's get specific then, Rodrigo, as much as you can. Who are the protesters and why are they making this happen?
Most of the protesters are part of an organization called CNTE. This is one of the two main teacher unions in Mexico. The CNTE used to be a very powerful union, strong links to the government. And it was led by Elvester Gordillo for more than 20 years until she got arrested in 2013.
And are these protests affecting other parts of Mexico as well?
Well, Oaxaca has been a key state for the mobilization, but other states have also seen several protests. Last week, for instance, in Mexico City, the CNTE protested in front of TV stations, corporations, government offices, and even attempted to block some of the main highways that connect the city with other states.
What are some of the specific issues that the teacher organizations are addressing here?
Since 2013, several unions and teacher organizations from public schools have protested against the education reform brought by the government of Enrique Peña Nieto. But they're also protesting after several arrests of their leaders, also some of the conflicts that they're having inside their leadership. But these teachers are also opposing to the key components of the education reform, particularly to the new requirement where teachers need to be monitored and evaluated by the state.
And what's the potential impact of the protest? Can they affect the economy in the capital city? And could it have reverberating effects dealing with the U.S. or border states?
Well, Mexico is a country with a long history of protests of this kind. Actually, protesting is a constitutional right, but sometimes the outcome becomes violent or controversial, like it happened yesterday in Oaxaca. The impact of this kind of mobilizations goes into politics, typically, where parties tend to oppose or support them, depending on their postures. But sometimes business organizations complain whenever there's a significant negative impact in their operations. Now, some protests affect in the short term in the operations of businesses, factories, and highways, as well as in traffic in some cities. But so far in this particular case, there has been no direct effect in the U.S. or in the bilateral relations between both Mexico and the United States.
That's KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau Chief Rodrigo Cervantes. Rodrigo, thank you for the update.
Thank you.
We When we think of trailblazing women in aviation, we think of Amelia Earhart and circumnavigating the globe almost a century ago. But tomorrow in Prescott, more than 100 women will take off from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott on a race across the country. The show's Lauren Gilger went up 8,000 feet in the air with two of those women as they prepared for the Women's Air Race Classic.
Clear. The sun is beating down on a tarmac lined with planes in Prescott, Arizona.
So I'm going to kind of get the cockpit ready for takeoff.
And Hannah Burright is sitting inside a Cessna 172S, going through a pre-flight checklist.
Check all of the instruments and make sure that the fuel gauges are set correctly. Put the flaps down, make sure those are working as well.
Outside, Shelby King is circling the tiny aircraft.
Make sure that all of our tie-downs are done. There's no dents on the airplane, our tires are all filled up. Nothing's leaking out in front. Make sure that we have enough fuel and oil.
Checklists crossed off, we pile in. This flight should last us about an hour this morning.
Clear prop.
But it's practice for a much longer one these two young women will be taking soon.
Advisors are good, flaps are up and confirmed, mixtures up, takeoff, doors are latched. All right, takeoff completed.
Burright is a senior at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in northern Arizona. King recently graduated and is now a flight instructor here. And tomorrow, the two will be one of more than 50 teams competing in this year's Women's Air Race Classic.
As requested, runway 30, cleared for takeoff, fly straight out.
The engine roars as we lift off the ground. Cockpit heats up fast.
Overfly the runway and you'll want to keep us at 6,900 and pretty much exact. Okay.
The race will be 4 days long and will span almost the entire country. This year, it starts at Embry-Riddle in Prescott and ends at their other campus in Daytona Beach, Florida.
This is what shows like our traffic so you can see all the other airplanes. So during the race, this will just be like filled with airplanes.
To win, they'll be racing their own handicap that Burright set on a test flight last month. But King flew the race last year, too, and she says the competition gets intense.
You want to beat your own time, but you're still like, I'm racing you.
It's a very intense time for these pilots. They have to manage weather, what altitude they should fly at, their fuel.
Michelle Day is the director of alumni relations for Embry-Riddle's Prescott campus and is helping plan for this year's race.
There's camaraderie. There's stamina, endurance, testing of yourself and what you and your team and your aircraft can handle.
And she says there's a legacy of generations of women pilots past.
The original started in 1929. They called it the Powder Puff Derby. And some of the women that flew in that were really, really brave and true pioneers because they were flying in aircraft that were open cockpit, no heaters, no instrumentation. They were flying by roads, they were flying by railroads to get to their destinations.
The Air Race Classic carries on that tradition today, dedicated to the tradition of trailblazing women in aviation and bringing new ones into the male-dominated field.
In this world of aviation, it has always been so male-dominated. So it's very important for women to show to everyone, men and women, that this is possible.
Day is a 1991 graduate of Embry-Riddle. Back then, she says she was one of about 8% of the student body who were women. Now it's about 24%.
We're going to practice the airport we're going to right now. We're going to practice flying over it at 200 feet above the ground.
During the race, they'll have to do this maneuver before they land at each of the 10 airports they'll pass. It avoids a cluster of planes trying to land all at once.
Yeah, so like right here, you can pull some so we can get down.
King pushes on the throttle as Burright tries to maintain altitude.
Yeah, it's kind of a lot of pressure on you. It's a lot of work because you have to make sure you're holding it. Yeah.
It's not easy. At cruising altitude, they tell me each bump we feel is the wind pushing us up and down about 100 feet. Back on the ground, they power down the engine and tie the plane down. Though they know the industry is changing, both young women say they still get looks when they step out of a plane.
Yeah, they're like, oh, you two ladies, like, you flew this up here? And you're like, sure did.
But they say they're proud they can do it.
It's possible. Anybody can do anything that they put their mind to. If you're interested in it, just go for it.
And
you can get pink headsets if that's what you're into.
Over Prescott, I'm Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
As we continue our celebration of the working life, we're looking at the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. We're thinking about the jobs around Metro Phoenix that might not be what you expect. To say it's getting hot in the valley would be an understatement. This time of year, many people may be getting their air conditioners serviced or replaced. So what happens to your old unit? Today, we step into a day on the job recycling AC units.
I'm Jason Martin, and I am operations manager for Carefree Recycling. I drive a truck. I dispatch. I do heavy equipment mechanic work here. I do a little bit of everything. A typical day for here is we start at 6 in the morning and we're done by 3. We have our trucks and we've got 3 or 4 pickup trucks that we just go out and we get AC units from the houses that are being replaced. This is our area where we break down all of our AC units and get our copper, aluminum, tin, brass. We even recycle down to the wire that's inside these units. And they've got small motors in them that run the fans. So the small motors, once those are broke down, they then come over to this corner over here where we have a plasma cutter. And that is how we extract the copper coil from these motors. So we try to get everything and we get it into bulk. And when we get large enough amounts, we take them in when the prices are right and we scrap it or recycle it. This is where we extract our copper. And once the copper is extracted, we wait till we have, I'd say probably at least 500-600 pounds of that. That's our most valuable commodity we have here. We have this bay right here. And this is where we evac all of our refrigerant. So that way we're not putting harmful vapors into the air. I would say that this job is not for everybody. It's very labor intensive and it's a dirty job, you know, with the heat and with the hard work. The one thing that's gratifying is that when I get home at the end of the day and I'm tired and I'm sore, I feel good.
That's Jason Martin recycling air conditioners in the East Valley. The Cleveland Cavaliers brought down the NBA's best ever regular season team last night, winning Game 7 of the finals over the Golden State Warriors. Cleveland had seen a pro sports championship drought of more than half a century. With me for a couple of minutes to tell us how the city is reacting is Tony Ganser of WCPN in Cleveland. Tony, how important is the Cavaliers' victory to the city of Cleveland?
It was like a collective sigh of relief and joy and kind of letting all of this pressure and tension of a region out. Because, you know, you talk about the half a century since a sports championship. It's not just that. Cleveland is kind of been a national joke, a punchline for so many people. Of course, a lot of people might think about, you know, the Cuyahoga River catching on fire, even though that wasn't a huge fire, so to say. I mean, it was a serious event, but that's what the city is known for. And Cleveland is kind of like Charlie Brown that keeps going up to kick the football, but it's pulled away at the last minute. So a lot of people were expecting this to really go poorly, even up until the final buzzer of that game. And when LeBron collapsed on the floor of Oracle Arena, I think a lot of people in Cleveland related to that feeling. Finally, this has happened. It wasn't a last-minute failure, and it worked, and we're winners.
So LeBron James is the centerpiece. Many people call him the best player in the NBA. And he is from Akron, not that far from Cleveland. Now, how significant is it that this homegrown hero came back and then helped bring the championship to the city?
I mean, LeBron James he's the cause of an emotional roller coaster for so many in Northeast Ohio. Akron's only about 40 miles from Cleveland, and we consider the region to be where we're from, Northeast Ohio. He's a native son, and he was coming up a superstar with the Cavs. And then he decided to leave. And of course, a very high profile, taking his talents to South Beach, and people burned jerseys in the streets. And it was just this letdown again, you know, talking about Charlie Brown. It was like, oh, no, we have this superstar and he's leaving. What's going on? For him to pen a letter, a love letter to Cleveland and Northeast Ohio, and to say he's coming back and he wants to win a championship, and then to do it, I mean, I really think this is going to make LeBron even more immortal, if that's even possible, in Cleveland lore. And, you know, he has a family foundation. He's focusing on helping especially urban youths get higher education and come out of really disadvantaged circumstances. So I think he's working on his legacy on the court and off the court, and people certainly appreciate him. And he really is a hero to so many.
Tony, finally, there are some Arizona connections with this Cleveland Cavaliers team. The general manager, David Griffin, was a high-ranking executive with the Suns, and even one of the key contributors last night, Richard Jefferson, went to the U of A. Arizona, Cleveland, who would have thought?
Yeah, apparently there's quite a few connections. I mean, David Griffin, of course, he, you know, one of the things that was said about him with his time with the Suns was that he was high on creating teams that were big on chemistry. And I think we saw that come through when he came to Cleveland as well, because one of the reasons he ditched the Cavs' former head coach, David Blatt, who he hired, was because there was this sense that the locker room was not united. So I think maybe that was a legacy. You know, his style from the Suns came over to the Cavs as well. And Richard Jefferson, a veteran who announced he would retire, he really gave it all in this final season for us and really showed up. Channing Frye, a late addition, also has Arizona ties. His three-point shooting was valuable during this playoff season and as well through the regular season. We should mention, though, I mean, on the other side, too, the Warriors, of course, have tons of Arizona connections with Steve Kerr, who also was in the front office of the Suns, Leandro Barbosa, who was with the Suns while I was there in Phoenix. So it seems like Arizona was well represented in the finals.
Tony Ganser of 90.3 WCPN in Cleveland, and as Tony alluded to, also one of our former colleagues here at KJZZ. Tony, thanks for the time.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
Cleveland rocks! Cleveland rocks! Cleveland rocks! Cleveland rocks!
Cleveland rocks!
Cleveland rocks!
Cleveland rocks!
Cleveland rocks!
Cleveland rocks!
Monday, Monday. Monday, Monday, sometimes it just turns out that way. Monday, Monday.
Hey guys, what's up, G?
Wanna go to Tchotchke's, get some coffee?
A little early. I
gotta get out of here. I think I'm gonna lose it.
Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
So it's Monday, the day of the week that's usually accompanied by pessimism and gloom. Most people look forward to Fridays or Saturdays. Mondays don't get that luxury. But there are different perspectives about what Mondays really mean. And right now I'm joined by longtime KJZZ commentator Robert Pala. Robert, when you think of Mondays, what comes to mind?
Well, I haven't had a real job in more than 30 years, so to me, Monday is really just any other day. But I think it gets a bad rap. I think Monday has a terrible reputation in our minds, in songs, in poetry. But it seems to me that Monday would be a really great opportunity to make up for the lousy week you had last week. It's sort of an absolution, you know. Okay, today's the first day of the week, and this is going to be the week that is really amazing, and I'll prove it today before I leave the office at 5 o'clock.
Well, you wrote a very personal New Times piece recently about how much you have to care for your mom. Now, Monday can be a special day for you when it comes to that, though, right?
It's true. Monday is my day off from my mother, and so I usually have a long list of things that I need to get accomplished on that day because I'm with her or I'm working the rest of the week. And so I guess I do have some inkling of why people hate or might hate Mondays, because that is the only day that I can get all of these mundane things done. I usually have a list of stuff that was supposed to be done 3 weeks ago Thursday.
Now, you're someone who's been even involved in a lot of things, but I think a lot of our listeners associate you with the arts. And Monday is not typically a day that really lends itself to going to a play or going out to a concert. It doesn't really seem that way. Is that a shortcoming that hurts Mondays as well?
No, I don't think so. Well, not for me. I mean, because when you're coming to my art exhibit, that means I've been working on Wednesday and Thursday and most of Friday to get it ready for Friday night. So Monday is still kind of a, it's not really a day off for me, but it's a day off from culture. And you're right, theaters are dark on Monday. So nobody's going to say, hey, come to my art opening on Monday night. Or,
but how much would that change it if you had that option? It wasn't always, hey, I mean, I realize why things are focused perhaps on Fridays and Saturdays. That's the end of the week. A lot of people have Saturdays off. But wouldn't it give Monday a shot in the arm if we could give Monday a nice art exhibit too?
I think a lot of it is in our heads. I think, you know, how, think about it. Monday we're complaining because we have to go back to work because yesterday was Sunday and we had the whole day off. But has that never happened before? Have we never awakened on Monday knowing that we've got another 5 days of school or work ahead of us? We need to knock it off. Give Monday a break.
Do you have a day that really stands out to you as one that, yeah, you know, in the course of a week, you just really don't look forward to?
I have more than half a century devoted to hating Sundays. I've always hated Sundays. When I was a kid, first of all, church first thing in the morning. I don't know any children who dance and sing because they have to be quiet for an hour in a dark room full of grown-ups. I hated church, so Sunday wasn't great. And then you'd get home from church and there was nothing on television. I don't know if that's still true, but you know, in the 60s and 70s, there was no programming. It was just anything that you watched would be lousy rerun or something that you wouldn't have watched in any case.
KJZZ commentator Robert Pala offering his perspective on Mondays as part of an occasional series here on the show. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.